study here on the book of Daniel this evening, and we're going to be going through the last approximately half of the book of Daniel. You know, the first six chapters of Daniel go through and primarily are a story of the events in Daniel's life coming up to events in Daniel 6 with Daniel in the lion's den. And then Daniel 7, which we went through last time, begins a series of visions that Daniel himself had. The vision in Daniel 2 was, of course, one that Nebuchadnezzar had had, and the other, the dreams that Daniel had interpreted either belonged to Nebuchadnezzar, as in chapters 2 and 4, or it was the handwriting on the wall to Belshazzar in chapter 5. But as we will go on through chapter 8, on through the end of the book, we find that the focus is no longer on the biographical information in terms of Daniel's life, nearly so much as it is on the visions that he had. And we start here in Daniel chapter 8. This is dated in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. You know, we had, if you, the story in the previous story, chapter 6, of course, we were already after the time of the Persian takeover and during the reign of Darius the Mede, but it's like that first portion, first six chapters, runs through sort of chronologically. Then chapter 7, 8, on to the end, the focus is on the visions, and those are recorded more in the chronological order of when Daniel received them. Now, this is the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. A vision appeared to Daniel, and was in Shushan, there in the province of Elam, and he saw this vision. And what he saw was there standing before the stream, the river, he saw a ram that had two horns. And the two horns were high. One was higher than the other. And the one that was the higher of the two is the one that came up last. So this ram was coming from the east and pushing west, and he was pushing north and pushing south. And nothing was able to stand before him, and Daniel watched in the vision and saw this big ram. And then he saw a he-goat coming from the west. And this goat came just flying across the face of the earth. It was like he hardly even touched the ground. And this was an unusual-looking goat because he had one great big horn coming up out of the middle of his head, had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had the two horns and ran at him in the fury of his power. I'm reading this primarily from the Jewish translation. I'll refer back to the King James. Anyway, I saw him come close to the ram, and he was moved with choler against him and smote the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to stand before him, and he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And none could deliver the ram out of his hand. And the he-goat magnified himself exceedingly, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up the appearance of four horns, directed in the four directions toward the four winds. And out of one of them came forth a little horn that waxed exceeding great, toward the south and toward the east and toward the beauteous land, which is, of course, the land of Israel. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and of the stars it cast to the ground and trampled on them, magnified itself even to the prince of the host. And from him, or by him, the continual burnt offering was taken away. Check here in terms of the statement where it says The King James and the Hebrew here is could be rendered by or from. He was the author of the action, taking away the continual burnt offering. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And the host was given over to it, the continual burnt offering, through transgression, cast down the truth to the ground, wrought and prospered. And so then Daniel hears a couple of these angels talking, and one asked the other the question, how long shall be the vision concerning the continual burnt offering and the transgression that causes appallment, or the abomination of desolation, as the King James renders it, and is the more familiar term to us, the transgression that causes appallment, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 evenings and mornings, then shall the sanctuary be victorious, or justified is the literal thing. The sanctuary just or righteous is the term. Now, Daniel, when he saw this, he wanted to understand it. Now, you know, we don't have to guess at what all these rams and goats are, because as you come right on through, we find that it is interpreted, and Daniel is told. Now, one of the things we find right here, and the Jewish translation renders it literally, unto 2,300 evenings and mornings. The King James just renders it 2,300 days. We call this sometimes the 2,300 days prophecy. But, you see, the Hebrew word for day is yom, like in Yom Kippur. But that's not the word that's used here. It's a very unusual term, and because it's unusual, the commentators sometimes are, some of the translators haven't always been sure exactly how to render it. I mean, they know what the words mean, because literally what it says is 2,300 evenings and mornings. And, evenings, mornings. It's not even the conjunction. It just says evenings, mornings. Erev and poker. Now, what are we talking about in context? Well, we're talking about the burnt offering being taken away, aren't we? How long is the burnt offering going to be taken away? When was the burnt offering made? It was made every evening and every morning. So the 2,300 evenings, mornings refers to 2,300 burnt offerings, you know, the evening sacrifice and the morning sacrifice, which would actually be, instead of 2,300 days, it would actually be, what, 1,150 days, because you're making an offering twice a day, once in the evening and once in the morning. Now, we're going to see as we go on through this that there was an exact historical fulfillment of that. And realize that we're... Let's just come on through a little further. He says Daniel says in verse 18, as he was speaking with me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face toward the ground. He touched me and set me upright, and he said, behold, I'll make you to know what shall be in the latter time of the indignation, for it belongs to the appointed time of the end. The ram that you saw having the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. So that makes sense. Here you've got this big ram, this male sheep, and with these two big horns, big, you know, just like a ram's horn, that represented the kings of the Medes and the Persians. And the rough he-goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And as for that which was broken in the place whereof four stood up, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not with his power. Okay, now, historically, we know exactly the fulfillment of that. I think virtually any commentary would explain that, because we know that the empire of the Medes and the Persians, starting from the east, conquered out. They went north and west and south. But then the king of Greece, Alexander the Great, started from the west, and he came running east. And just in a very short amount of time, he crossed everything from Greece all the way to India, and he smashed the Persian Empire, defeated them in 331 B.C. But Alexander, within a few years, he died by about age 30, and in the aftermath of his death, his kingdom, it was a Greek kingdom, the Hellenistic realm, but it split into four political directions. The four of his generals, Lysimachus, Cassander, Seleucus, and Ptolemy, wound up, each of them seizing part of the empire. And that is exactly the vision that you find here. Then we're told in verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom. Okay, here's the latter time, specific latter time we're talking about, the latter time of their kingdom, the latter part of the Greek, of the Hellenistic kingdom. When the transgressors have completed their transgression, there will stand up a king of fierce countenance and understanding stratagems, a very clever, crafty individual. His power shall be mighty, and not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and do. He'll destroy them that are mighty and the people of the saints. And through his cunning he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and in the time of security shall destroy many. He shall stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which has been told, is true. Now, you shut up the vision, it belongs to many days to come. Well, you know, if you follow the story through historically, the Persian Empire, which was yet future from Daniel's day. Remember, Daniel was writing in the third year of Belshazzar, and it was several years on, another 10 or 12 years into the future, before the Persians would finally conquer Babylon. And when they conquered Babylon, the Persian Empire, Medo-Persian Empire, seemed great, and it expanded. But Alexander the Great came, destroyed it, took over. But he died, and his empire split four different directions. Now, out of one of those horns came a little horn. Well, you know, a king of fierce countenance, a very clever, crafty individual who was responsible for what? Taking away the daily sacrifice. He was going to do all of this, and that's what we had, you know, we're told that this little horn that was mentioned back earlier in the chapter in verse 9, out of him came the little horn. That it was by this little horn, verse 11, that the continual burnt offering was taken away. Now, we know, again, that historically, who that's talking about, because there was only one time that the continual burnt offering was taken away. And it was taken away for exactly 1150 days. We know the dates. It's preserved in Jewish history, and First Maccabees, which was never intended as part of the Bible, but it is a historical account contemporary of the story of the Maccabees. That tells the story, gives the dates. It was a contemporary account. Josephus, writing a couple of hundred years later, drawing on Maccabees and other sources, tells the same story. And Antiochus Epiphanes was the king's name. He was a king that arose out of the dynasty, the Seleucid dynasty, the one that was north of Jerusalem, up in the areas of what would today be Syria, spreading across further east. And it was a in 167, right after the Feast of Tabernacles. Antiochus whose story is told a little more fully in chapter 11. Antiochus had sought to invade Egypt, and the Roman fleet had met him there and had basically said, you better go back home. We're not going to let you take over all of this. And so he went back home, but he was not in a very happy mood. He had previously entered into intrigue because Antiochus' idea was to, as was the idea of all of these Greek monarchs, to unite the world with Greek language and Greek culture. You know, Greeks viewed that there were two kinds of people in the world, Greeks and barbarians. You know, it's interesting. The Greeks and the Jews had an interesting mix, because the Jews viewed everything as there's two kinds of people in the world. There are Jews and Gentiles. The Greeks came along and said, no, there are two kinds of people in the world. There are Greeks and there are barbarians. And that was, so needless to say, you know, it's sort of like the irresistible force meeting the immovable object. What happened? Well, there was trouble. And Antiochus sought to entice them to join up. He wanted everybody to sort of worship the same God, speak the same language, follow the same customs, same culture, one world, the devil's way. We talk about globalism today as though that's some new thing. Well, you go all the way back to Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. That's where globalism originated. But it's one world, the devil's way. There will be one world when Christ comes back, but it's one world under God. Now, anyway, what Antiochus did on his way back is that he issued a decree that ordered the sacrifices to cease. This was right after the Feast of Tabernacles of 164, about 6-7 weeks later. He actually showed up with troops, and the sacrifices had stopped, but what he showed up with the troops to do is to put statue of Jupiter Olympus inside the holy place at the temple and to offer sacrifices to Jupiter. And he started out by offering a pig on the altar. And this is what the Jews call this setting up of the idol and offering the pig. They referred to that as the abomination of desolation, or as the Jewish translation renders it, the transgression that causes appallment, I think, is the expression that is used here. And it was an appalling thing. It was an abominable thing. And that's what he did. Well, provoked what was called the Maccabee Revolt, and it was approximately 3 years later that the Maccabees retook the Temple Mount in December of 164. And they cleansed the temple and rededicated the altar. And that gave rise to what was called, what the Jews call, the Feast of Dedication, or in Hebrew, Hanukkah. You read in John 10 about Jesus being in Jerusalem at the Feast of Dedication. A lot of Jews in this country sort of make it a pseudo-Christmas because it comes at, approximately the same time of year, but it doesn't have any connection with that. It goes back to this. So, interestingly, if you count back from the time when the altar was rededicated, in 164, if you count back to that date right after the Feast of Tabernacles, you come out to 1,150 days. There were 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices that weren't offered, just exactly what Daniel said. So we are able to see that. Now, what we're going to find is that what Daniel is describing in Daniel chapter 8 is a historic fulfillment of an event that, as you go further in the book of Daniel, and then you look at what Jesus said in the Olivet Prophecy, that what happened at that time was a type of an end-time event. Antiochus was a type of an end-time king. an end-time ruler, a type of this final beast power. But what we're describing in Daniel 8 is the historic flow. You know, Persia, Greece, a little horn arising out of one of these Greek kingdoms, this cessation for 2,300 days or 2,300 evenings and mornings, this sort of thing. Now, a couple of things I might comment on. It refers to him as having magnified himself. He's known in history as Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes is a title that he took to himself, and it means basically of, you know, the glorious appearing. It's the term that is used, you know, some of you, if you had a Catholic background, you may be familiar with Epiphany, you know, the Feast of Epiphany, which was the, you know, basically what it means is the appearance of God. The Greeks used the expression to refer to when the gods would make themselves manifest. So what Antiochus was in effect saying was that he was God in the flesh. He was Antiochus of the glorious appearing, the appearance of deity. Now the other thing it mentions is that he was cut off without hands. Evidently, according to history, he went into a fit, some sort of a seizure, and fell off of a balcony shortly after the rededication of the temple. In his palace, he went into this fit, this seizure, fell off the balcony, and died. So, he was, of course, looked at that and said, you know, God struck him down. He didn't die a natural death, wasn't killed in battle. All right. Now we pick up the story several years later, chapter 9. This is the first year of Darius. This is the same year as the lion's den, it's first year of Darius. Now, Darius, you know, a lot of the commentators, and particularly the liberal commentators, say, well, there was no Darius the Mede. Well, they're not reading it carefully. You know, what they're saying, in effect, is that Cyrus was king of the Persians at the time Babylon was conquered. That's right, but if you read it carefully, you find that Darius was, we're specifically told, of the seed of the Medes. He was evidently like a cousin of Cyrus, because Cyrus was Persian on his father's side, and the royal house of Persia on his father's side, and the royal house of Media on his mother's side. And his maternal grandfather tried to have him killed when he was born, so... Anyway, when Cyrus, it says that Darius was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. And there's the another similar expression back in chapter 5 when you have the account of the overthrow of Babylon. And... Well, chapter 6, verse 1, Darius the king, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And Darius was actually left in Babylon for about 3 years. Between 2 and 3 years, he was left there by Cyrus to be left in charge and served as king in Babylon. He was made king, see, in the sense appointed king, because Cyrus took the army and went elsewhere to destroy the main Babylonian army, which was elsewhere. So, anyway, Daniel dates this. He, we're told in verse 2, meditated, Jewish translation renders it, I, Daniel, meditated in the book. Over the number of the years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish for the desolation of Jerusalem 70 years. Now, Daniel was studying the book of Jeremiah. He was studying the Bible. Jeremiah was understood and considered to be part of the Bible, even though it hadn't been that many years since it was written. Daniel, of course, in the office that he held, had, you remember, he was put over all the wise men of Babylon? Well, wouldn't that mean that he was over the main library in Babylon? where were the sacred books of the Jews? Because all the sacred books from the temple, all the sacred vessels from the temple were brought to Babylon, right? Everything of value. So if Daniel was put over the wise men of Babylon, he was put in a position to have access to those books. That's one of the ways God ensured that the Old Testament was preserved during the time of the captivity. And later on, we're told that Ezra, when he returned to Jerusalem, that King Artaxerxes told him to rule according to the books that were in his hand. You know, he took back the Bible to teach it, and that's a different story. But it all ties in. Daniel is studying because, see, what happens? Like a lot of prophecies, it was clear that 70 years' wrath was going to be accomplished on Jerusalem. The question is, how do you figure that 70 years? Was the 70 years, did it start when King Josiah was killed in battle, the last righteous king? The 70th anniversary of that event had already come. The first year of Darius was the 70th anniversary of Josiah's death. Well, did that mean restoration? But see, it was a few years later, it was about 4 years later, that Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians, and that's when Daniel was taken captive. Then, several years later, the Babylonians came back and took the king, Jehoiakim. They took him captive, put him in chains, hauled him to Babylon. Then, several years later, they came back the third time, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, burned the whole thing to the ground. When do you start counting for the 70 years of desolation? Well, you go back and you read the verses in Daniel. There are two or three places that refer to the 70 years. And it's a little ambiguous. Daniel was studying it, and it wasn't entirely clear to him, and he had lived through the events. You know, one of the things, a lot of times, God's prophecies are very clear when they're all over with, very obvious that they fit. But, you know, sometimes when you're in the midst of it, always being able to know exactly which year is the starting point year for a particular prophecy isn't always easy. Usually there's something in there that maybe gives more than one possibility. Daniel, of course, wanted the early option. Say he was ready for Jerusalem to be restored. And he was coming to God in prayer, really beseeching God that the dating on this, you see, we're told that this is what? The first month of the first month of the year. And this is Daniel is really is really seeking God and trying to understand this matter. And so he prays a prayer of repentance to God, and basically not only for himself but on behalf of the nation. And he asks God to restore all of this as he has said that he would. And makes the point that he's not laying claim on his merit or anybody else's merit, but that to God's glory, that he would restore the temple, restore Jerusalem. And he beseeches God for compassion. And as you go through the prayer, and I'll tell you, it is, I have on a number of occasions have gone through that section of Daniel 9, thinking even in terms of events that we have experienced in the church in recent years, because it's, you know, it is analogous, let's put it that way. And I think as you read Daniel's words, you understand that. And, you know, that desire to see God's power made evident. And so he goes through all of this and asks God, and as he says in verse 16, to turn his anger and his fury away from Jerusalem. And then to incline his ear and hear, as he says in verse 18, to forgive, as he says in verse 19, And while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, presenting my supplication, while I was speaking in prayer, Gabriel appeared. And he said, here in the latter part of verse 22, Daniel, I'm come to make you skillful in understanding. He says, at the beginning of your supplications, a word went forth, and I came forth to declare it. You're greatly beloved. Now, look into the word and understand the vision. Now, Daniel begins to have something explained to him at this point that goes beyond. You see, he wanted to see Jerusalem rebuilt. But notice what he's told. 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to forgive iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and the prophecy, to anoint the most holy place. I think the King James says the most holy, but it is the Hebrew is Kodesh, Kodeshim. It is the term for holy of holies. He says, know therefore and discern that from the going forth of the word to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah, the Prince. Now, the Jewish translation, interestingly, renders this from the going forth of the word to restore and to build Jerusalem unto one anointed, a prince. Well, if you look at the Hebrew, it says Messiah. I mean, that's what it says, and that does mean in the literal sense anointed one, but it's talking about the Messiah. They try to obscure it a little bit in the Jewish translation, but unto Prince Messiah. Shall be 7 weeks and for 62 weeks. Now, 7 weeks plus 62 weeks is 69, right? It'll be built again. This is speaking of the city with broad places and moats and in troublous times. After this 62 weeks, shall Messiah be cut off and be no more. And the people of a prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end shall be with a flood. Unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. Now, let's stop there. We're going to come back, and we're going to look a little more here at verse 27. But let's look at one of the remarkable prophecies of the Bible. 70 weeks, of course, is 490 days. And this 490 days is divided into three periods. 7 weeks, which is 49 days. 62 weeks, which is 434 days, and then the final seven. Now, if you add it up, of course, what you you come out to is the seven and the 62 bring you up 483 days or 483 years. Now, we're told from the going forth of the decree to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem. Well, you can read in Ezra chapter 7 and verse 1. That was issued in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. And that was in 457 B.C. If you come forward 69 weeks, 7 plus 62, if you come forward 483 years, it brings you out to 27 A.D. From the going forth of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, there would be this period of 483 years. So, come 27 A.D., you would expect the Messiah, the Prince. Well, guess what? If you go through the accounts of the Gospel, it was in the fall of 27 A.D. that Jesus Christ was pointed out by John the Baptist as, behold, the Lamb of God who comes to take away the sins of the world. Worked out right on target. Then after this, and we're not told how long afterward, but after this period of weeks. Now, understand that all 70 weeks at this point have not been accounted for when the Messiah is cut off. 7 weeks. The 49 years. 49 years from 457, that would bring you out to 408. And I think that probably if you put the story together, that would bring you down to the book of Malachi and to the completion of things and the revival that took place at the time of Malachi. That was when the wall was built, the city was built with broad place and moat. It was troublous times. It was a difficult period. And, you know, there's very little. The only records of that time are the Bible in terms of what was going on. There are no other contemporary records. And the book of Malachi, I think, gives you the picture there. So that's, you know, you come down 7 weeks, and now the city has been finished, it's completed, the whole thing. Then you come 62 further, brings you down to 27 A.D., and the Messiah is here. But after this 7 plus 62, after, at some point after the Messiah's appearance, Messiah is cut off. And then, after that, the people of a prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Well, you know, that's, of course, exactly what happened. Messiah came, and then a period of years later, about 40 years later, the Romans came, and after a period of about 3 years of war, they destroyed the city and the sanctuary, 70 A.D. So, Daniel was anticipating the rebuilding of Jerusalem, and he was shown something even more. But, you know, if you're following through, you notice that this only accounts for 69 out of the 70 weeks. What's happened to the last week? Now, there are basically two different explanations that you can look at. The commentaries will, depending on which commentary you look at, they'll basically give two explanations. But let's look at, part of the key to understanding it goes back to verse 24. What, at the completion of the 70th week, see, one thing we have to understand is when the 70th week is over, then all the events mentioned in verse 24 will have occurred. We know when the 70 weeks start. They start with a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. We know that there is a gap between the 69th and the 70th week because the Messiah appeared, and Daniel stops his progression of the weeks at that part and explains that the Messiah appears and then a prince that will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. But notice when the end of the 70 weeks has come, verse 24 says, 70 weeks are determined upon your people and upon your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to forgive iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. Well, some of this you can say was fulfilled at Christ's first coming. But all of it wasn't. Has everlasting righteousness been ushered in? See, several of these seem to point toward Christ's second coming. As the, you know, will the most holy place be anointed? Will it be, well, if you read back in the book of Ezekiel, you read when the Messiah, notice here in Ezekiel 43 in verse 1. He brought me to the gate, even the gate that looks toward the east. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. Now, you know what's east of Jerusalem? is the Mount of Olives. Tied in with Zechariah 14. The glory of the God of Israel came from the way of the east. His voice was like the noise of many waters. The earth shined with his glory. That's the second coming. It was like the appearance of the vision that I saw by the river Kabar. Notice verse 4. The glory of the Lord came into the house by the way of the gate whose prospect is toward the east. And the Spirit took me up, brought me into the inner court. And behold, the glory of the Lord filled the house. And verse 7, he said unto me, Son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever. And my holy name shall the house of Israel no more defile, neither they nor their kings by their whoredom. Now, clearly that is descriptive of the second coming. And it describes Christ coming into the temple, which will, people wonder, what's the purpose of the temple in the millennium? Well, it's the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet. That's the place from which Jesus Christ will rule the nations. Now, let me show you something else. Where does that millennial temple come from? Zechariah 6, verse 12. Speak unto him, saying, Thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, Behold, the man whose name is the branch. He shall grow up out of this place, and he shall build the temple of the Lord. Even he shall build the temple of the Lord, and he shall bear the glory, and he shall sit and rule upon his throne. And he shall be a priest upon his throne. He's going to be both king and priest. That's referring to Jesus Christ, the branch. He's the one who will build the temple of the Lord, which is what it describes him coming into. You know, how long does it take Christ to build the temple of the Lord that he's going to come into from the Mount of Olives? You know, I don't think he's going to... a lot of things will be rebuilt over a period of time from a... You know, in terms of a rebuilding of the earth, but there's some things that are going to be done miraculously at the beginning. The healing of the water that's been turned to blood, and the restoration of life in the sea, that's miraculous. It occurs instantly. The stream of living waters breaks forth from underneath the altar in this temple, as you read on further in Ezekiel. So the point is, When will the Holy of Holies be anointed? Well, it'll be, I think, when Christ comes into it. I think the 70 weeks ends with the return of Christ. At that point, some things have been accomplished in his first coming, the rest of it in his second coming. So notice here that the 70 weeks, who is it determined upon? Your people, the Jews, and upon the holy city. So, the focus of the prophecy of the 70 weeks is what's going to happen to Jerusalem. See, that was the question that set this whole thing in motion. What's going to happen to Jerusalem? Well, he says 70 weeks are determined on your people and upon the holy city. And at the end of the 70th week, transgression will be finished. Sin will have been made an end of. Iniquity, you know, to forgive iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and the prophecy, to anoint the most holy place with the Holy of Holies. I think that you're looking at the beginning of the millennium. So we know that 69 of those weeks expired at the time when the Messiah appeared, from the going forth of the decree until the coming of the Messiah, 69 weeks. But the Messiah is cut off after that 69th week. And then the people of a prince come, and they destroy the city. And they destroy the sanctuary. But that's not the end of the story, because when you come to the end of the 70th week, then all of these other things mentioned in verse 24 will have been accomplished. So you have a gap. Now, some have sought to... And see, it works out. You see, the next verse here, the verse 27 in Daniel 9, and he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. And for half the week he'll cause the sacrifice and the offering to cease. And upon the wings of detestable things shall be he that causes appallment. That's Jewish translation. The abomination that makes desolate is the King James phrase. And that until the extermination, wholly determined, is poured out upon that which causes appallment. Now, see, the question comes in, who is the he in verse 27? Well, if you, some apply it to the Messiah, he'll make a covenant with many for 1 week, and for half the, and in the midst of the week, will make sacrifice and oblation. Cut off in the midst of the week and make in the midst of the week and cause sacrifice and oblation to cease. Well, the Messiah did have a 3.5 year ministry. And at the end, he was cut off in the literal midst of a week, of a Wednesday. He was cut off in the midst of a figurative week, in the sense of 3.5 years. Some have applied it there and said, well, the covenant is talking about the new covenant. And he was cut off in the midst of the week. And his death brought sacrifice to an end. Well, it's true that he was cut off in the midst of the week. And it's true that he paid the penalty for sin. But that still leaves you with half of a week left over. And where does that half week come in? Because you got 70 weeks that have to be complete at the time of his return. Now, another way of rendering it, you know, just let's look back. Let's read verse 26 and 27 together. After the 62 weeks, shall Messiah be cut off and be no more. And the people of a prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. But his end shall be with a flood, and upon the end of the war, unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. And he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1 week. And for half the week he'll cause sacrifice and oblation to cease. Now, who is the he? Is the he referring back to the Messiah? Well, it talks about the Messiah, but then later on in verse 26, it says, the people of a prince that shall come shall destroy the city. So the last, see, the question in interpreting verse 27 is, who is the antecedent of he, the Messiah or the prince? They're both mentioned in verse 26, but the prince is the last one mentioned. Now, the Hebrew is vague enough that in Hebrew, the antecedent doesn't always have to refer. In English, it would be pretty clear, because in English, normally the antecedent refers to the one just mentioned previously. In Hebrew, that's not always the case. A lot of times it is, but sometimes it's not. The expression here for, the King James says, confirm a covenant. But if you look it up, it is a different expression than is used anywhere else in the Old Testament. Basically, it means to make firm a covenant, or to make strong a covenant, giving perhaps the impression that the covenant was already in existence, but that someone came along to sort of firm it up, to enforce it. It's to be done for 1 week or 7 years. And halfway through it, the sacrifice and oblation ceases. He makes the sacrifice and offering to cease, and the abomination that makes desolate. Well, we know from the very end of the book of Daniel what? That the see, if you go back to Daniel 12, in verse 11, it says, from the time that the continual burnt offering shall be taken away, and the detestable thing that causes appallment set up, there's to be 1,290 days. Now, that's bringing you down to the resurrection. See, the other indication, and I'll just say it's something that we have not tended to focus on this part of it. It's something. It's a topic we've discussed several times in some of our Council of Elders meetings. And the problem, I would say, the biggest problem with applying that that part of it, if you try to say that the he in verse 27 refers to Christ, Christ did make the new covenant, and he did, his ministry was 3.5 years, but the sacrifices didn't cease, and they didn't even cease for the church. The proof of that is you can, they weren't offering sin offerings necessarily, but they were offering burnt offerings. Go back to the book of Acts, where James tells Paul to go in and stand for these men who have sacrifices. The Christians in Jerusalem continued to participate in the temple ceremonies right up until the temple, until they fled Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed. You could say, well, the need for sacrifices was ended at Christ's return, and in that sense it was. He offered one sacrifice for sin forever. But, you know, if you just take the most natural flow of it, the prince, we know that's Titus who came and destroyed the city and the sanctuary. That's a matter of history, 70 A.D. And desolations were determined all the way till the end of the Jewish war. Horrible. Well, that really then becomes a type of the end time, doesn't it? Christ used that, Matthew 24. He shall make, who? He, the prince, the Roman emperor, the beast, the successor of Titus. He shall make a firm covenant, or make firm a covenant, make strong a covenant, some sort of treaty. The word covenant is the same word for treaty, and it's used in a secular and a religious context in the Old Testament. For 1 week, a 7-year treaty. And halfway through, he betrays the, he turns things around, and he causes the sacrifice and offering to cease. We know from Daniel 12 that that is going to happen, and it is going to happen just over 3.5 years before the return of the Messiah. I mean, Daniel 12 is very explicit. Christ talks about the abomination of desolation in an end-time context in Matthew 24. So the advantage that that explanation has is it makes clear where's your week. Your 70th week is the final 7 years before Christ returns, because when the 70 weeks ends, then all the things that were spoken of in the earlier part of Daniel chapter 9 will have taken place. Daniel 9:24. So, at the end of the 70 weeks, finish the transgression, make an end of sin, forgive iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, seal up the vision and prophecy, and anoint the most holy place with the Holy of Holies. So that those six things will have been accomplished at the end of the 70th week. And so your question is, where do you put the split? Do you have 69 weeks plus a half a week, then a gap in the final half week? Or do you have 69 weeks, a gap in the final week? Well, I think the natural reading of it would tend more to this latter explanation, though that doesn't take away the fact, I mean, that the statements we've made before about the Messiah 3.5 year ministry and all of that is certainly true. I mean, that's that applies, but I think the sense, and you know, sometimes you find that there is a dual sense to prophecies that refers to more than one thing. I'll give you an example in the book of Joel, chapter 2. Peter quotes a part of Joel 2, and he applies it to the events occurring in Acts 2, to the pouring out of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. But you read Joel 2 on into Joel 3. If you notice, when Peter quoted it, he quit in the midst of a verse. If you read the latter part of Joel 2 on into Joel 3, it's pretty apparent that in the context, the end time is really the primary focus of it. But see, they're both right. Peter, under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, said, well, you know, it's describing what's happening here. It was. So sometimes when things are written in an ambiguous way, there's more than one way to take it. Well, maybe they're both right. But anyway, that's something that I gave you a little more focus on, I think that it flows. You have the 69 weeks, the Messiah comes. After that 69th week, the Messiah is cut off. We're not told how long afterward. Then the people of the prince come. They destroy the city. Well, see, you've got a historic progression. You've got Christ coming, you've got his crucifixion, then you've got your 40 years down the road when the city is destroyed. Then you come to the next verse, and he will make firm a covenant. Well, who's the he? You know, Titus did make a 7-year agreement with the Jews historically, which he broke. I think in that sense is a type of some final, you know, they may come out with some treaty that never is really enforced, and they're never able to really make it work until the beast power gets involved, enters in, gives the Jews permission to do certain things. But anyway, that's chapter 10 moves on that Daniel is now, this is several years later, the third year of Cyrus, and Daniel is fasting and really seeking God, trying to understand more about this vision, and trying to understand more of this whole subject. That's the whole point. Now, you find, interestingly, that Daniel is told in Daniel 10, verse 12, "Fear not, Daniel, from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard." And then you get a little insight into the spirit realm. You know, I was sent. I'm here because of your words. "But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. And I was left over there beside the king of Persia. And now I'm come to make you understand what's going to befall your people in the end of the days, for it's yet a vision for the days." Now, you know, there was struggle going on the spirit realm. You and I don't fully understand how do angels struggle. But in some ways, this angel was being interfered with by one who was called the prince of the kingdom of Persia. Michael came, you know, as the chief of the angels under God's authority, and one that has specific responsibility for Israel. Michael came and dealt with the matter, and this angel was allowed to come on here to Daniel. And so he tells Daniel in verse 20, "Know that I'm come unto you. Why I'm come unto you, now I'm going to return to fight with the prince of Persia, and when I go forth, the prince of Greece shall come." So there was, you know, a lot of times what we see going on the physical level, really there's another battle going on in the spirit realm. I think at some point in the future we'll understand that. We've given just a little insight into it here. So he says, this angel is the one that's speaking here in chapter 11, verse 1. "As for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to be a supporter and a stronghold unto him. And now I will declare unto you the truth." So he says, you know, I've been dealing with some of this, and there are going to yet rise up three kings in Persia. There were three primary kings or major rulers. The fourth will be far richer than they all. And when he's racked strong through his riches, he'll stir up against the whole realm of Greece. That's speaking of Xerxes. He's the fourth one. And then later, a mighty king shall stand up. This is the Greek king. "And shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, the kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds, not to his posterity." So we've already looked at that. We have Persia followed by Greece. Alexander dies, and his empire is split. Now, I'm going to pass out something to you at this point. This prophecy in Daniel 11 is the most detailed prophecy in Scripture in terms of historic historic detail. And I'm not going to try to go through every name, date, and place, but I've given you a verse-by-verse rundown, and you can go through and study that out, because if I try to go through it all verbally, it will enable you to do that. What we start is a very detailed story of what happened between the Testaments. The starts out by talking about the empire split four ways of Alexander, but then it very quickly focuses in on two, a king of the south and a king of the north, because there were only two of the four successors of Alexander that played an important part in the story of God's people. That was the kingdom of the Seleucids north of Jerusalem and the kingdom of the Ptolemies south of Jerusalem. And so we quickly get to them, and we trace through the struggle and all of the intrigue and the things going on between the king of the north and the king of the south. And you track it through in chapter 11, and you see that... Let me just show you as we go through sort of the break point. See, verse 31, chapter 11, verse 31. Arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, shall take away the daily sacrifice, and shall place the abomination that makes desolate. Well, we know about that. We know when that occurred. Because, again, we get back to Antiochus Epiphanes and the events of the abomination. Such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Well, what you find, of course, is some of the Jews collaborated with Antiochus, and they betrayed the covenant. And we find there were those, the Maccabees, who were strong, who did exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many. They'll fall by the sword, by flame, by captivity, by spoil many days. And as you get to verse 15, many of them of understanding shall fall to try them, to purge, to make them white, even to the time of the end, which yet for a time appointed. So, beginning here with the days of the Maccabee revolt, in just a few verses, we have summarized the whole history of the people of God for centuries, and we're now down to the time of the end, verse 35. And now we come in verse 36 to a king that'll do according to his will, magnify, exalt himself above every god, magnify himself above all, verse 37. At the time of the end, verse 40, shall the king of the south push at him, the king of the north will come at him like a whirlwind. We're now down to the events of the time of the end and the beast power. So it becomes apparent when you look at chapter 11 is that Antiochus was a type of the final beast. And so there are things we can learn about the events of the end time from looking at the events surrounding Antiochus. You remember when Christ talked about the abomination that makes desolate? He says, the one spoken of by Daniel the prophet, this is where Daniel was speaking of it, let him that reads understand. And Christ attached it to the end time. So there is an end time fulfillment of what had occurred anciently. I'll let you go through the write-up on chapter 11 to go through the details of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids one by one. But let's pick up the story with Antiochus. And in verse 21 of Daniel 11. This is where I'll leave you to go through the handout to bring you up to that point. In his estate, speaking of the predecessor king, shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now that's what Antiochus did. He was not the normal heir, but he intrigued, and he is described here as a vile person. But he came in peaceably and obtained it by flatteries. I think that tells you something about the final beast and how he's going to come to power. I think Antiochus is a type of that final beast. He's a vile person. He comes in peaceably and obtains it with flatteries. It's interesting, you know, that's exactly how Adolf Hitler came to power. He was a vile person. You know, they didn't really want to give him the honor of the kingdom. He came in peaceably, made a lot of promises, flattered certain ones. He had come out with the largest block in the Reichstag, but not a majority. And they wound up, some of these smart guys thought that they could control him, and that backfired on them. So he describes the verse 23, after the league made with him, the prince of the covenant would undoubtedly historically refer to the high priest. After the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully. He'll come and become strong with a small people, enter peaceably into the fattest portion of the province. Which again, you can tie in, you see, even with what we spent a lot of time on in Daniel 9. What does he do? Well, after the league, this is obviously a... Let me check right here on the Hebrew before I comment on what it was. It's the term for covenant. The Taha Brit. Brit is covenant. Brit-ish means man of the covenant, by the way. B-R-I-T, that's covenant for... You know what the name for the United States is in Hebrew? If you read an Israeli newspaper, of course they don't say United States. That's an English term. The term in Hebrew is... Hartzot Habrit, which means literally translated the land of the covenant. That's their name for the United States. So anyway, just sort of interesting. He says that, see here in Daniel 11, that after the league, after the treaty, the covenant, well, is that referring to the covenant that he makes strong, that the prince makes strong, after the league or the covenant, he's going to work deceitfully. See, and he comes in, he enters peaceably. You remember Christ said, when you see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, know the desolation thereof is near, flee. If those armies come with guns blazing, you don't need somebody to tell you the desolation thereof is near and it's already a little late to flee. I think that if you put that together with here in verse 24, he enters peaceably. You know, comes in, he's makes excuses. He gets his armies in place. But he comes in peaceably, but he doesn't stay peaceable. He's working deceitfully. That's why Christ told his disciples, when you see it, don't be gullible and just think, nice man, he's here to help. You better get out. Know that the desolation thereof is near. They've showed up, and everything's going to break loose. So he enters in peaceably, and he does what his fathers haven't done. It describes here what he does against the king of the south. It is a very apt description of diplomacy, verse 27. Both these kings' hearts shall be to do mischief, and they shall speak lies at one table, but it shall not prosper. Isn't that a good description? You know, think about Hitler and Stalin when they made their pact before World War II. Both of their hearts was to do mischief, and they spoke lies at one table. Well, it's not just Hitler and Stalin. I mean, it's any number of times people have sat down at one table, and each of them was plotting in his mind to snooker the other one. And they just sat there and looked the other one in the face and smiled. And, you know, you just had a peace conference between the Palestinian leader and the Israeli leader. Probably not a bad description of what was going on. I suspect there were lies spoken at one table. Anyway, the So we find that in verse 28, his heart shall be against the Holy Covenant, and he'll do exploits. And it describes literally what happened with Antiochus, how he came back down to Egypt. Verse 30, the ships of Kittim, which was the Roman fleet. Kittim was an ancient name for Sicily. They didn't let him do what he wanted to do in Egypt, so he came back. He returned, had intelligence with them that forsook the Holy Covenant. He entered into intrigue with apostate Jews, polluted the sanctuary, took away the daily sacrifice, placed the abomination. I mean, that's the historical description. Antiochus did that. And then you have the revolt. But it is at this point you begin to clearly skip on down to the time of the end. And we find in verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will push at him. Undoubtedly, you've got the civilization that was anchored on the south shore of the Mediterranean, the civilization anchored on the north shore. The king of the south, king of the north, the Islamic world will undoubtedly be the very end time. Some prominent individual will arise over there and push at the king of the north. What does that mean? Is he going to declare an embargo, or what's he going to do? Well, the result is the king of the north is going to come at him like a whirlwind and a real blitzkrieg. He's going to overflow, enter into the glorious land, verse 41, use that as an excuse to occupy the land of Israel. Many countries will be overthrown. Certain ones will escape. Egypt will not escape. So he's going to invade, but, verse 44, tidings out of the east and out of the north will trouble him. In the aftermath of that, tidings out of the east and the north. Well, that's, if you tie it in with the book of Revelation and other things, you find, of course, that the kings of the east, which Revelation says are going to put together an army of 200 million men, I can't give you a list of all the ones. The Bible gives a list of some. I think it's very obvious just from the demographics that to put an army of 200 million men together, you've got to have India and China involved, because nobody else can put an army of 200 million men. Both of them, they're the only two countries that have over 1 billion population. They're obviously providing a tremendous amount. What happens is they've all been sort of tied together, at least in some sort of economic combine with the beast power. But when they see what he does in the Middle East, they begin to get nervous. He gets word that, they're unhappy. He has the idea that he's going to take them out too and show them who's boss. At that point, you go back to Revelation and look at look at what happens with the trumpet plagues, how Europe strikes Asia, and Asia comes back and strikes Europe, and things are going to begin to unravel, and it's at that time, chapter 12, verse 1, that Michael shall stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people. And there will be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. Everyone found written in the book, many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth will awake. Some to everlasting life, some to shame. Everlasting contempt. So there's the resurrection. At that time, the very time of the end, Michael will stand up. You see, there's been a time of trouble, the great tribulation. Christ referred to it in Matthew 24, time of trouble such as never was. Jeremiah 30, verse 7 refers to it as well. And it's at the end of that tribulation that Michael stands up and the people are delivered. And the time of the resurrection. Daniel was told, verse 4, shut up the word, seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many will run to and fro, and knowledge will be increased. Now, interesting, the description of the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge will be increased. If you look at the 20th century, you find a remarkable thing. At the beginning of the 20th century, most people traveled the way they had always traveled. You know, most of us, you look back, certainly the generation of our parents or our grandparents, how did they farm? They farmed with draft animals. You know, I look back at, first job my father had when he was a teenager back in the early 1920s was driving a wagon of mules that was hauling timber to the first oil derricks in southern Arkansas. The 1922, the Smackover Field, the first oil in that whole area. Well, they built the derricks out of wood. And how did they transport the timber from the sawmill to the... Well, they transported them on a wagon pulled by mules. Now, in just a few years, by the time World War II ended, well, the mules and draft animals were becoming a rarity. But you don't have to go back much further, much earlier than World War II. In fact, if you ever see the newsreel footage of World War II, I think it's one of the most remarkable things. I need to try to get the footage and try to work it into a program sometime, because it's one of the most remarkable pictorial fulfillments. The opening shot, of course, was Hitler's invasion of Poland. And the newsreel footage made at the time, the Polish cavalry, you know, they were on horseback. And you see the Polish officers, you know, with their sword telling the troops to charge. The opening shot of World War II was, you know, the men on horses ready to, of course, Hitler's troops weren't on horses. Here you open with somebody on horseback, and of course, you know, the final shot of World War II is the mushroom-shaped cloud over Nagasaki. I mean, it's a remarkable thing. 6 years separated a general on a horse from the mushroom-shaped cloud. The 20th century, in the lifetime of one generation, the automobile, the airplanes, all of these things that came on. You know, it's Mr. Armstrong's lifetime. He tells the joke about when he was a little boy. The first cars had been invented. He'd never seen one, but he'd heard about them. And they were there in their house. He was a little boy, and his father was there to win it. He says, "Here, come quick, a horseless carriage." Well, he and his sister came running over there looking out the window. What they saw was a carriage pulled by mules. And his father thought that was really funny. You know, they'd run to see a horseless carriage. It was. It was pulled by a mule, not a horse. But, you know, in his lifetime, nobody had ever flown an airplane. There were no airplanes. And yet, by the end of his life, he was riding in a jet. You know, if you were to chart out a chart 60 inches, 5 feet long, an inch for each century, it'd be the last inch out of that 60 before you got to automobiles, airplanes, many running to and fro. I mean, up until the 20th century, if you wanted to go somewhere, you walked, you rode on an animal, or you rode in something pulled by an animal. And by 1969, we put a man on the moon. You realize, you know, the Wright brothers, what was it, 1903, when they flew the first, took off from Kitty Hawk? 66 years. Knowledge will be increased. You know, television, computers, all of the rapid technology. The 20th century was a unique time of the end. Many will run to and fro. Knowledge will be increased. So that is descriptive of this time period in which we're living, and going back, let's say, to around the time period of World War II to the time of the 20th century in a remarkable way. So Daniel wonders how long, verse 6. And he was told, verse 7, time, times and a half. When he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. And I heard, but I understood not. And I said, "Oh, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" And he says, "Go your way, Daniel. The words are closed up and sealed until the time of the end." You know, it's interesting. You know, when Mr. Armstrong understood some of these prophecies, you know, it says in Psalm 111, last verse, "A good understanding of all they that do his commandments." You know, the first thing Mr. Armstrong came to understand was about the Sabbath. Actually, the twin subjects of evolution and the Sabbath, proving the existence of God, the Creator, and understanding about the Sabbath. And it was only after he had started keeping the Sabbath that he began understanding prophecy, a good understanding of all they that do his commandments. See, that was, God began to open up these things. Sealed up until the time of the end. Many will be purified, made white, tried. That's just an overall summary of what's happened. You know, people have been converted. They've gone through trials. The wicked will do wickedly. None of the wicked are going to understand. The wise will understand. See, wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord. And so you understand that who's really going to understand? It's not going to be those who are following their own ways. From the time that the daily sacrifice will be taken away, and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there's going to be 1,290 days. Blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,335 days. But go your way till the end be. You're going to rest and stand in your lot at the end of the days. Now, let me just make a little comment here. You know, you got two periods of days that are different. They're 45 days difference, 1,335 and 1,290. Do they start at the same time and end at different times, or do they end at the same time and start at different times? Well, I think the key is verse 13. Go your way till the end be. You're going to rest. Daniel's going to die, see, and sleep in the grave, and he will stand in his lot at the end of the days. All these days end at the same time. They end at the return of Christ, the resurrection. So 1,290 days before the resurrection is when the sacrifice is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate set up. Well, something happens 45 days earlier than that. It doesn't say what that is. It says just blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,335 days. I don't know a definitive answer. I think that it has something to do with God's work and perhaps with the end of the work as we know it. Perhaps a time when God's people leave. Those who are going to go to, if we're going to go to a place of safety, then we have to get there. We're told by Christ, if you wait until the armies surround Jerusalem, he says, let them that are in the countries not enter therein. Don't, that's not the time to come to the Middle East. When you see the armies surrounding Jerusalem, that's the time to get out of Jerusalem. But in order for somebody to get out, they got to get there. When are they going to come? Well, I think it's probably connected with this. I'll show you one other thing. You know, we often comment about the time times and a half a time are 1,260 days. If you notice, of course, that's 30 days shorter than this 1,290 when the abomination is set up. All of these periods, the 1,260, the 1,260, the 1,290, the 1,335, they've started different times, but they all end with the return of Christ. Let me show you something in Daniel chapter, or not in Daniel, in Hosea chapter 5, a couple of pages over, talking about Ephraim and Judah. Hosea 5:5, the pride of Israel testifies to his face, therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity, Judah also shall fall with them. That has never happened in antiquity, that Ephraim and Judah fell at the same time. But that is going to happen in the end time. Notice, verse 7, they have dealt treacherously against the Lord. They have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. Well, the difference between 1,290 days and 1,260 days is a month, isn't it? I think the setting, based on that, tying these verses together, is the armies surrounded Jerusalem and the sacrifices are made to stop, and in the course of that month, Israel and Judah fall. So that by the end of that month, the tribulation, the great tribulation, has begun. That's why you get 1,260 days. It becomes the way to to sort of line all those things up. If you want to chart it out, draw a line for the return of Christ, come back 1260 days, then come back 1290, 30 days earlier, then come back 1335, 45 days earlier. And the 1290 is the abomination. The 1260, see, that final 3.5 years is the time of the two witnesses prophesying in Jerusalem, the time of the Great Tribulation. And that 30 days in between the 1290 and the 1260 is Hosea 5:7, the month shall devour them with their portion, is the time period when the Israelitish nations fall and go into captivity. So, anyway, we've covered a lot in Daniel, and I hope that we haven't answered everything, but hopefully we have given you some things to think about, some things that will be helpful. And with that, we'll be concluded this evening. I have study questions on the book of Hosea, which we will go into next time.